6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. Thanks so much for joining us today. We have a really exciting show today. Talking about the latest of the biggest thing to hit Madison in the last decade, maybe forever. Let's make it as big as possible. Let's hyperbole the whole thing up. We're talking about Act 10. I have with me today Lester Pines and Tamara Packard with Cullen Weston Pines and Bach, who are fresh off their arguments of the Supreme Court, arguing in defense of Act 10, sort of the big case that we've been waiting for almost 4 years in the making.
We haven't been defending Act 10, though.
Acting in defense.
Oh, my goodness.
Colossus decision holding it unconstitutional.
Defending the constitutional rights to assemble.
That's right.
Arguing against Act 10. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad the lawyers are here to correct me. Excellent. Well, let's sort of get right into it. What were you arguing before the Supreme Court last week? It was a little tricky, and sort of there's so many cases flying out there, and you were talking about a stay, and you're talking on the merits of whether this law is constitutional or not. What is before the Supreme Court right now?
There are two big main questions. One is whether the provisions that we challenged are unconstitutional, and the other was whether until we get a decision on that, from the Supreme Court, whether the WERC can apply the provisions of Act 10 regardless.
WERC, tell us what that is.
Sure. The WERC is the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. They're the state agency that's charged with implementing and enforcing the Municipal Employment Relations Act. The Municipal Employment Relations Act was amended by parts of Act 10. And after Judge Colas found those parts to be unconstitutional, void, and without effect, the WERC said, well, that's all fine and good, but we're still going to apply these new parts of Act 10. And so they went ahead and did that, which we think was really lawless. It was very lawless behavior.
So in September of 2012,
correct,
there was a decision by a circuit court judge, Dane County Circuit Court Judge Juan Colas, who ruled that parts of Act 10 are unconstitutional. And therefore, by definition of something being unconstitutional, it's unenforceable.
When a statute is found facially unconstitutional, it is unenforceable, it is void, it is without effect. And he said as much in his decision in September 12. That's right.
So he makes this decision, and then the WERC, which is the state arm that helps move forward negotiations and conversations with municipal employees, they move forward anyhow. So
right.
This case rose up to the Supreme Court on its own, and you were arguing whether the lower court's decision was right or wrong. You're arguing the merits. What should be the outcome? Is Act 10 constitutional or not?
Correct.
And the second piece, which is, meanwhile, we have a lower court ruling and you're ignoring it.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think the bigger part is the constitutionality of Act 10. So can we talk a little bit about that piece of what are the arguments of why Act 10 isn't legal?
Well, it's a complicated argument. So let me see if I can make it as clear as possible for the listeners. Essentially, there is a rule of law which says that if there is an associational right, that associational right cannot be conditioned on... Actually, I'm saying it backwards. That is that where there is a benefit that's extended by the government or the state, that benefit cannot be conditioned on, at least in our opinion, the abandonment of an associational right, which is what the law is in this state. That is, it was based on, our argument was based on a 1955 decision, which said that if the state provides for public housing, that it cannot condition living in public housing on giving up an associational right, in that case, being a member of a subversive organization, the Communist Party, because the state had a law in 1955 that said, we are making available public housing to you, citizens of Wisconsin, and if you want to live in this public housing, you have to say you're not a member of a subversive organization. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said you cannot condition a public benefit on a requirement that a citizen abandon a constitutional right of association.
So let's break that down a little bit. So first, before the law, before Act 10 existed, before any of that, you have a right to associate.
That's right. That's a fundamental constitutional right.
It's a fundamental. Now, is that an implied constitutional right? I know that sort of, it doesn't say you have a right to associate, but that's implied and has been determined that you have a right to associate, meaning Tamara and I can go meet up and talk about anything we want at any time. They can't say you can't form a communist party. They can't say you can't get together a group of people and talk about your wages and talk about should we get paid more, should we strike, should we talk. Is that sort of the idea of what your associated right is?
That is exactly what your associational right is.
Okay, and that,
and the right to get together, to talk, to plan, to seek to influence one's employer through group activity is a right which pre-exists any regulatory scheme such as the National Labor Relations Act or the Wisconsin Labor Peace Act or the Municipal Employment Relations Act. That is a pre-existing constitutional
right.
It's
a bigger law than that, regardless of all the laws that have been imposed subsequently. This is a constitutional fundamental law that exists.
It's a fundamental right that exists.
Fundamental
and then
right.
the laws that were passed to regulate that right.
Okay. So if we start with that foundation, then Act 10 comes in and Act 10 says you can still have this union if you want, but you have to do all these different things. Is that the argument? Is that you? So you're.
What our argument was is that the flip side of the case from 1955, where you had to give up your associational right, is that that the state cannot condition a benefit which affects an associational right by penalizing people who continue to engage in the associational right. Just as you couldn't say to people who were given the benefit of living in public housing, you can live in public housing, but the manager of the public housing agency gets to hit you with a baseball bat every day while you live there. Or you know, you have to pay, you know, some kind of exorbitant kickback to the manager of the public housing or something like that. You can't condition a benefit on, you can't condition associational right with a penalty. That is, it, you can't require a person to give up the associational right, and you can't penalize a person for engaging in the associational right.
So what Act 10 did was it said, you can use this structure of collective bargaining that we have put in the statute to talk to the employer about what you want to see in the workplace. But you can only negotiate, you know, wages up to a certain amount, and this base wage thing. You can, if you want to use this structure, you have to have annual elections and have your collective bargaining agent selected by the supermajority of 51% or more of people who are eligible to vote, by which Lester got their attention by pointing out that none of the Supreme Court justices could have been elected under those kinds of expectations or
even one who ran unopposed.
Nobody could. Well, so yeah, let's pull that out a little bit. So yeah. we've got the right to associate, and then they're saying, okay, you can still collective bargain, but if you collective bargain, you have to jump through all these hurdles that are. So,
punitive.
They're punitive. That you make it so that no one in their right mind objectively would look at this and want to do what they're doing, which is the whole argument you're imposing on their right to associate and be part of this group, because you're making it so punitive and so impossible to succeed that no one would see any merits to wanting to be a part of such a group.
Right. And the point is this: there is no constitutional right to collective bargaining. And there's a distinction between there's a right to associate for purposes of collective bargaining, but there's no constitutional right that says that the state must engage in collective bargaining with you.
That was one of my favorite parts on reviewing the oral arguments. You got to be there in person. I watch it through Wisconsin Eye. Anyone can watch it on Wisconsin Eye. Just go to Wisconsin Eye and look up, you know, Act 10 oral arguments, and your pretty faces pop up. I just forgot the point I was going to make. My goodness.
Well, but the point that we made was, and the substance of this argument is that when the state offers the benefit, that is a benefit that it doesn't have to offer, the benefit is we will engage in collective bargaining with you, it then cannot condition that benefit on subjecting those people who seek then to take advantage of the benefit by taking punitive measures against them, the most significant of which is restricting their ability to get a wage increase to a cost of living on their base wage, which is a wholly misunderstood provision of Act 10. The base wage does not mean their current wage. It means their starting wage. So if you've been a teacher for 30 years and you're making $70,000 a year, your base wage is the starting wage for teachers in that school district, which would be, like, say, $29,000. So you're restricted to getting a wage increase on that $29,000 base of a cost of living. If someone's making $70,000, but they can only get a cost of living increase on $29,000, their real wages in comparison to inflation will never, ever, ever increase. In fact, they will always decrease over time, unless there's deflation, which is unlikely.
So let's break this out a little bit. And you're reminding me of the point I wanted to make, which was you had said, and when I think of the more striking comments that you said at the oral arguments, was you could restrict collective bargaining. If the state had passed a law that said no collective bargaining, done, period. You don't find there's no violation in that.
Correct.
That's correct.
They could just get rid of MERA entirely.
That's correct.
But the point is that they're still allowing you to do it, but they're allowing you to do it in such a way that penalizes you. It actually moves you further back than an even playing field.
That's correct, especially in comparison to non-unionized employees.
I'm talking with Tamara Packard and Lester Pines, the attorneys that were just arguing the merits of collective bargaining and arguing against Act 10 before the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. Okay, we already have a caller coming in. Thank you, Molly. All right, thanks for calling. Let's hear your question.
Hi, I wish I was hearing something a little more positive out of you guys this afternoon. And I would also say, if this is all you got to offer, it sounds like the tactic to use is strike. That's all I've got to say.
Well, yeah, let me comment on that. First of all, I'm not in the business, and neither is Tamara, in the business of, at least on this program, or at least before the Supreme Court, saying what the alternatives were to engaging in the legal process. My actual personal opinion was, when Act 10 was being proposed, remember when it was proposed on a Thursday and was supposed to be passed on a Tuesday, that there should have been a total 100% general strike of all public employees in the state. That would have been the most effective tactic to have used to defeat the legislation. But that wasn't something that the unions were able or willing to organize, and perhaps it wasn't necessarily the best tactic. That would have been an appropriate response. Given that that was not the response, then the question is, what tools are available to help to save those organizations and to save this right for public employees? And So the decision was made to turn to the courts. And so in the last 2 years, approximately, because of the efforts of those of us who did this litigation and other law firms that did litigation, a number of public employee unions have negotiated contracts through June 30th, 2015. So it is not as if nothing has been accomplished.
And this is one piece of the many things going on. So today we're talking about the legal piece that the two of you are bringing forward in the collective fight against Act 10. So let's break down, keep breaking that down. So we have an associative right. Now they're putting limits. Let's talk a little bit about that. So you told us details about the whole issue of you can't really get a raise, that you have to negotiate on your base wage. Talk to me about the percentage comment, Tamara, you were talking about.
The elections?
Yeah, and Lester's great point about none of you would be elected.
Yeah, so Act 10 says that in order for a union or collective bargaining agent to continue to be a group of employees agent in collective bargaining, the union has to pay for and go through an election every year, which they have to win by 50% or better, no, more than 50% of all of those people eligible to vote in the election.
Not the people that vote, the people eligible to vote.
That's correct.
Right.
So if 50% of the population votes on a race,
every single one of them plus one would have to vote for the union.
So that is your point of everybody loses.
It's very difficult to win an election like that. And that was the whole point. That is, it was to create an almost insurmountable obstacle. And I should point out, however, that a number of unions have met that obstacle. But the other obstacle that is placed in the way is the absolute prohibition on allowing members of unions to have their union dues deducted from their paychecks, despite the fact that public employees routinely are allowed to have dues or contributions to other organizations deducted from their paychecks. So the combination of the restriction on negotiable wage increases to a cost of living on the starting wage or base wage, the refusal to allow employers to have dues taken out of employees' paycheck voluntarily, and this requirement that every year the people who choose to associate have to prove to the employer through an election run by the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission that more than 50% of all the people eligible to vote, whether they decide to vote or not, have voted in favor.
Support.
These three things are cumulative burdens. And they're cumulative burdens on the associational right that preexisted the regulatory structure that the state has offered as a benefit. That's our argument.
Now, the Attorney General argues that everyone right now has the same right. You could go to your employer and say, I want a raise. You could go to your employer and say, you're not treating me well. I need a different job, hire, fire, all those things that anyone has a right to.
That's true.
And so then the union, even with all these added obstacles, it's still a possibility that it could happen. So it's just an added extra benefit. So what is your, how can there be an argument that you're taking away a right to associate when you can still do anything you want? You still have all the rights to argue for wage increases and anything you want from your employer. Plus, we're going to allow you to have this union. Yes, you have to jump through these impossible hoops, but we're giving you that, and if you don't want it, just act like everybody else.
Well, first of all, the Attorney General's argument on that point was wrong, and he suggested that within the regulatory scheme called the Municipal Employment Relations Act, that any employee can go and negotiate anything outside of the law with their employer directly. That's false. Once there's a chosen agent, the employer is required by law to deal only with the agent. So
he just doesn't understand
what a union is.
He doesn't know what the law says.
He didn't understand how it works.
So
just but, wrong.
But here's my question to you then. Isn't that sort of a catch? But can it work both ways?
No.
Little bit of, well, you're choosing to be in a union that says only our union representative bargains.
It's right. Not the union that says it. It's that the law says it.
The law says it.
The law says once you choose a collective bargaining agent, that person is the exclusive agent for all negotiating all your wages, hours, and working conditions.
So wouldn't you argue that that's an added burden to all of this, is that the way the law is written, you don't have the rights that he argues you still have, so then you can't be penalized because of it?
The law has always said that once you select a collective bargaining agent, that agent is your exclusive agent. I suppose you could say that by combining that factor, which in and of itself isn't really a problem, with all of the other new factors, then it becomes a penalty.
Let's put it this way. The whole purpose of this law, the purpose of changing the collective bargaining law for municipal employees, which includes school district employees, was to make the collective bargaining process so unappealing and to make maintaining a collective bargaining agent so difficult that employees would choose not to engage in that process anymore. So the legislature gets it both ways. They don't abolish collective bargaining. They just make it so impossible that people choose not to engage it and the public employee unions go away.
And they can point and say, we gave you the choices. And look, once we gave people a choice,
look at
what they chose.
That's exactly right.
And that's exactly why this constitutional principle about unconstitutional conditions is so important. That in fact, under the Wisconsin Constitution, the United States Constitution, the government can't give you an option, you know, can't say, here, we'll give you this thing that we don't have to give you, but if you use it, if you take it, then you have to give up these constitutional rights. That's the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions. You can't do that.
Well, I would think that would go to the answer of our first caller's questions of what's the point to doing this? The point to doing this is that so we can have this argument, so we can actually call them on what they're doing. What you're doing is creating a penalty. What you're doing is manipulating the people. And if it happens, that's fine. But we want you to know we saw it. We know it. We documented it. It's written down. And history is not short.
And it may turn out that we're right and the state is wrong and we win.
So let's talk about that. What are the thoughts? Now, first of all, I applaud both of you. It must be incredibly exciting and exhilarating and terrifying to be up there. Now, have you both been to the Supreme Court before?
Yes.
You both have.
Yes.
So it wasn't your first time there, but still.
We're all really tight, good buddies.
When you go up there and you talk, it's really fascinating. Tamara, you were being peppered with questions from both sides, and does it play in your head? You think, okay, a question from Justice Abrahamson, who in general holds the same position that I may be advocating. Of course, you can never tell, and that is true. But in general, you were sort of on the same side. So then do you think, okay, I really better listen, really? Because there were sometimes she asked questions, and you're like, nope, that's not it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the questions, it actually doesn't matter who the questions come from, because sometimes they're asking questions that they know somebody else has or has raised in a discussion, in a debate before the arguments happened. And so it's not really her question. It's really, you know, Justice Rogensack's question. But Justice Rogensack doesn't want to ask me that question because she doesn't want the answer, right? And so Justice Abrahamson makes sure that that question gets asked. So it doesn't matter who the question's coming from. The question, what matters is what the answer is.
Right. And of course, the strategy in an oral argument is to try to make a personal and intellectual connection with the justices and the individual justices, because the arguments are made in writing, in briefs, and then they read them.
In theory.
And then
the arguments, in theory.
Right. But the purpose of oral argument then is to pick out certain points to reinforce those points through speech rather than through writing. And
personal
also
connection.
Personal connection, and also to clarify matters that perhaps were not clear from the written arguments. And despite the enormous amount of time that lawyers put into writing the arguments in briefs, the reader of the brief doesn't always get every single point. And so the oral argument gives a judge the opportunity to ask questions. And it also gives the lawyers an opportunity to perceive from the questions or comments of the judges where they might be confused about a point that was made in the briefs.
Do you think the oral arguments matter? Do you matter substantively with the outcome? Do you think that in general, and this is people on your side, not on your side, do you think in general they already have made their minds up and the oral arguments are not persuasive, or once in a while they are, or all the time they are?
I have to say,
most of the time they are.
Yeah, most of the time they are.
Most of the time they are worth it. I mean, sometimes they're not worth it because the answer is just so clean cut and nobody really needs to spend the time with additional argument. And I suppose on occasion, even if the legal question is complicated or the answer is complicated, I suppose there are going to be judges who just have already made up their minds and don't want to ask any more questions. But for the most part, at least, I mean, people have think they have a general direction on where they think the decision is going to go. I think judges tend to have at least a tentative position, but maybe something that they're not quite clear on, or it's a piece of the puzzle that they need some clarification on. I think that arguments are really important for, you know, sort of sussing that out.
I mean, you know, we don't, and I don't think any competent appellate practitioner goes to an oral argument cold. We do practice arguments with people who are
people
not
interrupting you and asking you questions.
Right.
Stop with that.
Right.
But wait, I want to ask you this.
Yeah, Tamara got assigned her part the day
Sunday
before.
Sunday afternoon.
But
you couldn't tell.
I went in cold.
But generally, you know, we practice the arguments with, you know, unbiased people. That is, people who aren't
how
connected.
Did you find an unbiased person on Act 10 in Madison, Wisconsin? Did you leave the state?
There are people who are professional neutrals.
Neutrals. Yeah.
They work at it.
They work at it. And those people, we did mock argument with a group that provided feedback about things that they thought were unclear in the briefs and things that they thought were helpful in the arguments, were unhelpful in the arguments. And you do that to help mold the most effective argument possible.
So, and that practice session was very helpful in helping figure out exactly what we should focus on.
Right. So I have to say that my argument was not something that I did, and neither was Tamara's argument, something that she did, you know,
without thought.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't one part of it was, you know, on the spur of the moment, but 99% of it was practiced.
Do you want to tell us the spur of the moment part?
Well, that was about the Titanic.
Okay, yeah. So let's hear the best joke that made it into the paper. That goes to your point of personalizing it and saying, okay, I'm not a piece of paper with a legal argument. I'm here. Yeah. It was in response. You didn't mean to make this. But,
well, no, that's true. The Attorney General, in response to a question from Justice Bradley, who suggested that the parties' arguments had passed like ships in the night, which actually was a very excellent observation because the state never really did respond in the briefs to our argument except to give our arguments the back of their hand and say these are just ridiculous arguments. They never really did grapple in the briefs with the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions or the cumulative nature of what we consider to be the detriments that were put on the constitutional right. And then the Attorney General's response was odd, in which he said, they're not passing like ships in the night. The ships have collided, and our ship is bigger, and we shall win. It was just an odd statement, you know. And as I was sitting there, I thought, well, the Titanic was a big ship, too. And that led to
an hour and a half later when I got up
to argue, what I did is I used that. Bear in mind, the court had now listened to 2 hours or more of argument.
And they were supposed to only go 90 minutes
right.
for the
so,
whole thing.
You know, in structuring the argument, then I wanted to get up and get the court's attention. You know, and so that's why I pulled up the Titanic argument. I said, well, the Titanic was a big ship too, but it ran into an iceberg that was smaller than it, which ripped the ship apart and it sank. And the state, you know,
Act 10 has run into
an iceberg. Also, when it's called the Wisconsin Constitution.
That's what I liked. So when I heard you saying that, I'm thinking, okay, where the iceberg? No, you're not the iceberg.
No.
That was interesting. He said, I'm the state, I'm the ship. And you said, there's an iceberg, and it's called the Constitution.
Right. You know, and it's just good rhetorical argument.
It definitely, right. It's the memorable part. Well, it got quoted in all the papers that hitting each other.
Right.
Basically, everyone was talking about what a snarky thing to say when you're trying to be before the Supreme Court and have a bunch of, you know, a little bit of deference to each other. And in general, everyone was polite to each other. That's not a very polite thing to say.
Well, I kind of interpreted it as my ship's bigger than yours.
It was kind of cocky.
You know, weird.
You know,
right.
Like, you know.
Oddly inappropriate. Well,
it was a little strange. I could have said something equally snarky in return.
No, yours was...
Eyes classy.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep it classy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the snarkiness of the Attorney General. And that gets into this whole side piece of it, which was sort of strange. The whole stay issue. We're here arguing the merits. It's odd why we're even also talking about the stay. But we're talking about the stay because not only are they saying we disagree and the trial court should be overruled, but meanwhile... They're disobeying what the trial court said.
Right. Yeah. So in September 2012, we got this decision from the trial court that said these provisions of Act 10 are unconstitutional, null and void, and without effect. And at the time, like right then in September of 2012, there was no enforcement of those provisions because there was already a federal injunction. But then in April of 2013, the federal injunction was dissolved. And so then we saw the WERC starting to actually implement these provisions that were found unconstitutional, null and void. And we're like, what the heck?
How can you do that?
Right. What the heck? So then actually some other unions came in and went to Judge Colas and said, hey, the WERC is implementing these provisions against us, but these provisions are unconstitutional. You know, WTF, we don't, you know, save us from this, right? And so Judge Colas said, yeah, actually, they are in contempt. They're in contempt of my original order, and they have to stop doing that. And here are a bunch of things that they have to do to clear themselves of this contempt.
So meanwhile, the Attorney General was arguing the trial court had no right to tell the WERC to stop.
Right.
The trial court had a right to say, hi, this law is unconstitutional, unenforceable, you shall not enforce it. But then when they disobey it, they're arguing that the trial court had no right to stop them.
Toothless.
That doesn't make it. I mean, were they really arguing that you can disobey the law?
They seem to be arguing that the trial court can issue a declaratory judgment telling everybody on the planet whether the law is unconstitutional or not, but that without a direct specific injunction to the WERC saying don't do anything with these provisions that I just told you are unconstitutional, that they can still use these laws that are actually not laws.
So, I mean, I want to clear
through
Wisconsin the legal
Supreme, speak. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has said on more than one occasion that when a statute is held to be facially unconstitutional, that it is void ab initio, it has no effect, it is not a law, and it cannot be enforced against anyone. That's the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision.
Someone forgot to tell the Attorney General.
Years ago. It wasn't like we are not asking them to make that decision today. That was the latest time they said that was in 1998, which, believe it or not, is almost
what, 15 years ago. Right.
You know, but that was just the latest time that they said that. So the Attorney General had taken an unusual position, which was that the declaratory judgment, which said the law is facially unconstitutional, was only effective as to the plaintiffs, that is, MTI and Peggy Coyne, and that it had no impact on the defendants except insofar as the defendants wanted to enforce it against MTI. That was an extraordinary legal position that has no basis in Wisconsin law, as far as we were able to tell. I think the problem with the argument in the Supreme Court on that was that because of the timing of things, everything was rushed in terms of the appeal to the Court of Appeals, the request for a stay from the Court of Appeals, which was denied, and the Supreme Court saying we'll take that up at the same time as we take up the substance. Which
it's a strange mix. It's almost like the silly sideshow.
In a certain way, what the Supreme Court was trying to do is say, we want to get all of this done. Let's take all of it together. But the problem is, it's not a really good idea to rush stuff. And that's why there seemed to be confusion in the arguments about what was going on. Plus, the court said the unions who filed the contempt action in the first place could not participate in the oral argument.
And they made that decision on Friday at 10:37 p.m. before the Monday arguments, which is how I managed to be making these arguments. Oh, guess what? Surprise. We're going to be doing this.
It's your turn. Yeah. Right. We have some calls coming in. Thank you so much for waiting. Tell us your name and your question.
My name is Mitch. And first of all, I want to thank you guys for coming on the show. This is a great show. And personally, I really love to hear the insight on how you've been, handling and arguing the case. My question is, if you could share with us, we know that these laws have appeared all over the country. We've learned about ALEC in the last couple of years, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the Koch brothers have lobbyists set up in the state. Do you guys know who actually put the pen to the paper in drafting these laws? That's my question.
We don't know.
Oh, no.
But we suspect because of the way that the law was drafted, that it was likely drafted by lawyers in Wisconsin who were very familiar with the Municipal Employment Relations Act and the State Employment Relations Act, because the act was so well drafted and so specific that it's unlikely that it was sort of a model draft from ALEC or someplace out of the state.
Does it fit our law so well?
Yes. Somebody thought long and hard about how to do this. This was not done overnight.
Lawyers and legislators that were anticipating the election of Governor Walker?
I think the law was probably drafted immediately after Governor it was probably drafted well before Governor Walker was elected. But just not, they couldn't use it until they had the majority in both houses and a Republican.
We have another one. We have one more call coming in right now. Thanks for waiting. Tell us your name and question.
Yeah, hi. My name is Mazuswa, and I've got a few comments first and a question. I was interested in what you had to say about public housing at one time by the state being attempted to be off limits to members of the Communist Party. Which reminds me of the fact that although it's a federal law, the Taft-Hartley Act pretty much said the same thing, that at least union leadership could not be members of the Communist Party either. So I see a very ironic parallel there. My question is this. In the event that you're unsuccessful with respect to the present arguments, is this the type of case that could be taken to the federal level, and would you likely attempt to do so should the Supreme Court not act aggressively against Act 10 and essentially uphold it? Is that something that you would contemplate doing? I'll take my answers off the air, and thanks for an interesting program.
Yeah, what's next?
Well, first of all, we'd have to see what the Wisconsin Supreme Court rules and whether they base their ruling on the Wisconsin Constitution, which we've asked them to base it on, or if they expand it to rule on the U.S. Constitution.
And when do we anticipate that?
I expect to see a decision sometime in March.
Okay.
In terms of potential appeal, number one, if you lose a case, you got nothing to lose if you appeal. The only appeal would be by a petition for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, which the court could either grant or not grant. But then you have to ask yourself, if you, that is from our point of view, if we got an adverse decision from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, would it be worth our while to seek to get that overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, and would there be any likelihood of that happening? The nature of the United States Supreme Court is such that it would be a difficult case to get them to accept. I don't think that they would accept a case involving the interpretation of state law and like this. But, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. I hope that that's a decision that the state has to make.
So what, there's other cases out there. There's this lawsuit that by MTI that was pursuing. It seems like there's a couple different levels going on. What else is still out there, and what does this, the decision on this case by the state Supreme Court, what does that mean regarding the other cases?
There's one other case left besides ours, which was a case that was recently decided in the circuit court. And my sense is that if the Wisconsin Supreme Court rules against us and reverses Judge Colas, that case will probably not go very far. So basically what I'm saying is the case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court is probably the definitive case.
This is it. Yeah. And is the other case that's still out there, does that have a different legal argument? You have the association case argument. You also have an equal protection argument, which is similar to the argument today.
It has a different argument.
And there, I suppose it's possible that people will identify some other constitutional arguments. I mean, there have been several, three or four different cases that have been brought challenging Act 10 in one way or another, but each of those cases has challenged Act 10 in a different way. So it's possible that somebody will come up with another new theory, something that we haven't, you know, tried. We hope that our argument was, you know, the best
winning
one, then the winning one. But, you know, I'm all for people coming up with even better ideas.
But one thing I want to point out is that, you know, the legislators who passed this, the extremists who passed this legislation, I don't want to call them Republicans because they're extremists. And
it's an insult to the Republicans out there.
It's an insult to people who
have brains.
Were Republicans. traditional Republicans.
Yes. I grew up in that family. My sister listens to my show. Hello, Aunt Jody.
Anyway,
the
point I want to make is that they never dreamt that when they passed that law in February of 2011, that in February of 2014, there would still be strong and effective public employee unions in the state of Wisconsin, and there will be.
Yeah, every day that goes by that the Supreme Court doesn't grant the stay to the trial court's decision, every day that the WERC is not implementing and enforcing the unconstitutional provisions of Act 10 is a day that labor unions are having conversations with municipal employers and negotiating contracts. The Kenosha Education Association last week, because of the contempt order, and because now the WERC is following the original order of the trial court, the KEA negotiated a contract that's carrying them through beyond the next election.
So let's apply that here locally. I have the good fortune of serving on the Dane County Board. We have continued to negotiate in good faith with our unions and have continued to have collective bargaining and have positive results that benefit the community
and collectively bargain full range contracts.
Right. So we have done that. It's a joy to do it. We have done that subsequent to the passage of Act 10, but it's currently, you know, on hold, right?
Because both the employer and the unions in Dane County agreed that Act 10 was not, you know, legally enforced.
I would think that short of the Attorney General saying otherwise, everyone would agree that it's not legally enforced
right.
at the moment because a judge said as much.
Right.
Now, when if Act 10 gets upheld by the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. what happens to all these collective bargaining agreements we have done subsequently?
Well, there are going to be lawsuits by right-wing organizations to try to void those contracts. So that's going to be the next round. But then that leads into the constitutional protections against impairment of contracts. So we're not worried about those.
What could possibly be the argument that you shouldn't have proceeded because we should have sat around and waited and held our breath? How does government function that way?
The argument will be that the court's decision was not effective as to that particular employer, and the employer was not covered by the court's decision. And
that's back to the AG argument.
Right, exactly.
Which, on some level, I would love to see. My thought is that argument is so frivolous and ridiculous that I would hope, on some level, that the Supreme Court will address that when it addresses the whole big picture. But maybe they don't want to address it.
You don't really want courts to address things that they haven't been asked to address specifically.
But they were asked to address the stay.
They could, in the process of addressing the request for a stay, say things that will signal where they would go, in these kinds of challenges that could come later. But they're not going to say straight up or down. And as for those contracts that were negotiated between September 12 and now,
right.
this is the effect on those contracts. They're not going to say that because they don't.
Could they possibly rule on the stay before March when they rule on merits?
They could rule on the stay today.
Is that anticipated? They haven't yet.
But we don't know.
It's only been a week.
We don't know if we knew.
I mean, the criteria for granting the stay would be that there is irreparable harm to the state to not allow the state to go ahead and enforce this law. That's more or less. And that the balance of the harms, that it's more harmful to the state and the public for the law, for Act 10 to not be enforced right now than it is for it to
be enforced.
So
it's tricky.
But this the ruling on the stay does not require a ruling on the merits, which is why it's all really kind of weird and convoluted.
That it was all mixed. Is why, from someone from the outside watching Wisconsin, I trying to figure out why the heck are we arguing all these different pieces when really there's just one issue that ultimately is going to be decided in this.
And they may well just, ultimately not rule on the stay. They may say, here's the decision on the merits and the motion for a stay is now moot. And so goodbye and good luck.
Right. And welcome to the world of appellate civil practice.
So we only have a couple minutes left, but I wanted to sort of ask you then, let's say we are meritorious. Let's say you have done your excellent job and are persuasive and win the points. Do you think that then the legislature is going to come back and respond?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with extremists. They will pass something else. You're dealing with a governor who will sign something else. But they'll have to do it in a constitutional way. If the court says, no, the way you did it was unconstitutional, they're going to have to go back to the drawing board. But believe me, they will not just sit still and say, oh, we lost. They will do everything they can to disrupt public employee unions. They hate public employee unions. They hate anybody who doesn't completely agree with them. They will do anything to destroy those organizations. They will get as much money as possible. That's how they're operating, and we're stuck with it for a while.
And if the Supreme Court rules that it is constitutional, then there'll be the argument of what happens in the gap in between and whether to move
right.
forward to the next level.
Yeah,
well, and then also you'll find unions finding other ways to act collectively.
Like what?
Employees will act collectively outside of the collective bargaining structure.
It brings us back to what we talked about, that is the right to
right
organize
to associate.
And associate for purposes of trying to influence your employer is not a right that is granted by a statute. It is a pre-existing constitutional right.
It's a fundamental right
a fundamental
that some people
right.
say even pre-existed the Constitution.
Right.
So we can all still get together, talk to each other, and say, hey, tomorrow morning, one by one, let's go into the employer and say, I want a 50-cent raise.
Or let's all go in together.
Or the employer can sit down a meeting, confer, and instead of having a collective bargaining agreement, they can adopt ordinances. That's how it was before 1959. And the whole idea that public employee unions are going to go away because of Act 10, it's ridiculous. They're not going to go away. They're just going to be different. And in fact, not only if they're different, they might even be better. They might get back to grassroots and they might get back to having to have more and more people participating rather than depending on their leadership and their employees to take care of their problems.
The trickiness is that grassroots is a lot of
grassroots.
Work. It's a lot of work. It's not easy to pull everybody in all the time.
Well, that's true. But you know what? You know, having real wage growth stay stagnant since 1970 is also a really, really bad thing. So it may be that people are going to, in order to get back to real wage growth, they may just have to spend some extra time trying to deal with their employers in a more aggressive way.
Well, we are at the end of our show. I want to have a big thank you to Tamara Packard and Lester Pines, my first repeat guest, Lester. Thank you for taking that official position there.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your advocacy and your leadership and your representation of the Dane County values and the Wisconsin values and maybe the United States values and fighting the good fight. And as always, we will live for the next fight no matter what it is. So thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you to Molly for engineering this hour. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a fabulous day.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. The time is now coming up on 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Right after this announcement.